This is a download from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. On April 11, 2008, the Society hosted Dr. James H. Jones, professor of history at the University of Arkansas, and author of Kinsey, A Public-Private Life, and Bad Blood, the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment.
Thank you very much for coming out. As you all know, this is the last speaker of the semester, and what a more appropriate speaker to have than Dr. James H. Jones himself. I'm very excited to have him. I just want to give a quick summary of kind of an introduction, and then we'll get started. He's a former professor of history at University of Arkansas and University of Houston. He has had a very lucrative career as both a biographer and a history author. In 1993, he published his first book, Bad Blood, The Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment. Following that, the book was widely heralded, in examining both the catastrophic effects of the experiment and more specifically the moral dimensions that were breached during the experiment. In 1997, he followed it up with Kinsey, A Public-Private Life on the Father of Sexology, Alfred Kinsey. Like his previous work, Kinsey is a must-read for anyone who's interested in the life or the field of sexology. It was subsequently nominated for the 1998 Pulitzer for biography. But as it stands, Dr. Jones is one of the leading experts on Dr. Kinsey in his field. So the presentation is befittingly on Kinsey's life and is titled Science in the Bedroom, Alfred C. Kinsey, Covert Social Reformer. So with that, please welcome Dr. Jones.
Thanks.
Thank
you very much, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I am delighted to be invited by the Jefferson Society. I've done a lot of gigs in my life, but I don't think any has given me this much pleasure. So thanks for having a geezer. I thought what I could do to repay you for your kindness in having me, and I thought I would share with you a piece of research that may go toward that debt. Psychologists at Stanford studied group behavior in audiences that listened to lectures. And what they discovered was that within a 50-minute period, there is a very high probability that each of you in this room will have at least one sexual fantasy. So stick around, something good can happen. Okay. I want to begin hostage of some notes, because I want to read something to you just to make sure we're talking about the same guy. The person I will open with is a man named Billy Graham. And Billy Graham, when he wrote these words, was an up-and-coming, very young evangelist. In 1949, he wrote, and I quote, "It is impossible to estimate the damage this book will do to the already deteriorating morals of America. It is an abomination." Second quote, this gentleman is J. Edgar Hoover. "It is important to the very future of our national life that we hold fast to our faith. Man's sense of decency declares what is normal and what is not. Whenever the American people, young or old, come to believe that there is no such thing as right or wrong, normal or abnormal, those who would destroy our civilization applaud a major victory over our way of life." Close quotations. When you get America's most promising young evangelist and America's top cop after you in the same breath, you have stirred the pot. Okay, why the fuss? What's it all about? In 1948, Kinsey published a volume entitled Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. In that book, he revealed a number of statistics about male behavior that shocked the American public. First of all, he revealed that 90% of the males he had interviewed had masturbated. Second, 85% had engaged in premarital sexual activity. 45% had had extramarital sex. 50% had engaged in mouth genital contact, oral sex. 70% had patronized a prostitute. 37% had had at least one homosexual contact. 17% of rural boys had had carnal knowledge of infrahuman species. Come here, sheep, you know. And finally, Kinsey insisted that 95% of the American males would conform to the data that he had suggested. In other words, his data were representative. In 1953, he published his second study, the follow-up, to find out what the women were doing. And if you think that the reaction to the first volume was heated, and it was, I'll say more about that later, the reaction to the second volume was a bombshell. As a matter of fact, when the female volume was published, I'll digress for a minute, the Russians exploded their first hydrogen bomb, and Kinsey published the female volume, and guess which event got bigger headlines? Okay. Women. 62% of the women had masturbated, he interviewed. 66% had had nocturnal sexual dreams. 90% had petted, and by petting, he meant below the waist. All right. 50% had had premarital intercourse. 26% had had extramarital intercourse. 13% had had at least one homosexual contact that led to an orgasm. And 3.6% had had at least one sexual contact with a lower animal. Now, when he published this data, he was talking about mothers, sisters, grandmothers, nieces, you know, the flowerhood of American woman. So this volume was exceptionally controversial. All right. That's sort of the, the data. Who's the guy? Who's the guy? If you can see this book, you see a very tweedy professor, okay? Bow tie, he loved Harris tweeds, he was squared away, and there was a carefully cultivated persona with Alfred Kinsey. It went like this. Kind of dull, nerdy professor, sturdy Midwesterner, but with a flinty New England background, and prototype workaholic, same time, dedicated family man, wife, four kids, professor of biology, and to his fingertips, a simple Baconian scientist, an empiricist, who was there to give you, like Joe Friday on Dragnet, just the facts, just the facts. No special pleading, no axe to grind. I'm a scientist. Here is a lacuna in the scientific knowledge. My job, science abhors a vacuum, and my job is to fill it. That's the canon. All right. When I was a graduate student, I was trained in American foreign policy. And I thought I wanted to study sugar economy in the 19th century. I was going to tell you more than you wanted to know about Cuban sugar economy. And one of my professors, with whom I took a class in social and intellectual history, devoted 1 week to that class to private life. And in that week, we read Freud, as we should, and we read Kinsey, and we read a few other people who weren't quite as heavy hitters. With Kinsey, and Freud, I was struck immediately, okay, by the contrast. With Freud, like him or no, you're in the presence of a genius. He's a great theoretician. And like geniuses everywhere, he sucks up all the oxygen around him. He leaves us feeling kind of bad about ourselves. Why aren't I that smart? And he leaves us, wanting to penetrate the theory and figure out how that paradigm works. All right, with Kinsey, you read Kinsey, and you think at first blush that you're in that presence of the Baconian scientist. But then you read a little further, and you see a guy between the lines waving a hand, and you see a guy who cares passionately about the issues he's writing about, and he's anything but disinterested. He is a seeker, and he wants you to go with him on that voyage, and he wants you to walk down his garden path and come out at his location with the understanding he wants to plant in your head. Okay? He is a person with a big axe to grind. All right. I'm very interested in ego psychology. I'm very interested in what makes people tick, and I'm very interested in American culture. So the challenge I faced when I decided not to do sugar economy, but to work on Alfred Kinsey, was to put together a set of cultural issues and to put together a complicated life. What I learned was that Kinsey came out of, really, the Victorian world. He was born in that late 19th century, really Victorian Edwardian. And he grew up in a society that was enshrouded, okay, with the conspiracy of silence. The conspiracy of silence meant that you don't talk about sex. There are things for polite conversation, and there are things that are not for polite conversation, and you don't talk about sex. But if you look at American cultural history at the beginning of the 20th century, sex doesn't stay under the cookie cutter. Arm pokes out, a leg pokes out. It keeps, you can't keep it under the wraps. There's something called the social hygiene movement, all right? The social hygiene movement is the effort of reformers at the turn of the century and going into the 20th century to stamp out venereal disease and prostitution. Guess what that does? That puts sex in play. People start talking about it. Divorce, practically unheard of in earlier times, in 1913 reaches the epidemic proportion of 1 in 10 marriages. We would look back on that with great nostalgia as being a very stable society, right, maritally speaking. But the fact that it was on the radar screen started talking or getting people to talk about the dynamics of a private life in marriage. Kinsey comes of age, okay, in a society that's trying to come to grips with the elephant in the room that no one's talking about. It's there. Human sexuality, okay, is something each of us experiences, none of us escapes, and yet it was a topic that you could not discuss. Let me punctuate this. I'll flash forward. The year is 1934. The guy who will become the Surgeon General of the United States, Thomas Paine, writes a book entitled Shadow of the Plantation, or excuse me, Shadow Over the Land. And it's a clarion call to do something about syphilis in our society. He tries to go on the CBS radio network to discuss the book, and the word syphilis is censored. He can't say it on the radio. All right? The sex education movement in American society really dates from the progressive era. It really dates from those efforts of social hygienists to do something about prostitution and venereal disease. But the thrust of that educational movement, whether at the high school level or the college level, was all the same. Keep it in your pants, okay? Keep girls, women, keep your knees locked. Guys, keep it in your pants. And just say no, that was the mantra. And with regard to discussion about birth control or things that might have been useful information, you didn't cross that bridge, all right? Again, the conspiracy of silence. What the great gynecologist Robert Latu Dickinson called hush and pretend. Hush and pretend. I love the phrase. All right, Kinsey is born in 1894 in Hoboken, New Jersey. He is born into a deeply religious, fundamentalist Methodist family. I would say that he was reared in the admonition and nurture of the Lord, except I don't think there was much nurture. I think there was a whole lot of admonition. His father was an overbearing, domineering patriarch. Have you guys seen the Kinsey movie? Anyone in here seen it? Okay, you know the figure in that? Okay, that's not a stick figure. That's a snapshot of the real Alfred Kinsey's father, who was Alfred Seguin Kinsey instead of Alfred Charles Kinsey. Kinsey is a sickly child. He has rheumatic fever, and consequently he is shut in. He's not allowed to run and play, and he develops this kind of fantasy life. As he is cut off from the activities of other boys, he really has to struggle with the question of masculinity. And he's struggling at this question of masculinity when our culture is experiencing a crisis of masculinity. If you look at American male image at the turn of the century, there's no accident, okay, that the Boy Scouts come along then. There's no accident, you know, that the young Christian, YMCA, starts getting guys on the mats and having them wrestle with each other and be virile and stuff. With the closing of the frontier, there was a great deal of fear, you know, that if you couldn't go out and kill an Indian or, you know, rape and pillage, what are you going to do to demonstrate masculinity? The Civil War was behind us. There were, you know, the splendid little war, Spanish-American War was okay, but there weren't enough guys to kill. So, you know, how do you assert your masculinity? Well, you do it by these anachronistic, wonderful things like the Boy Scouts that take an urban population and teach them rural skills. I mean, think about it. It's a hoot. But they also teach them, you know, notions of trust, identity, man, strength, you know, virility. Okay, Kinsey is raised in that culture. I tried to find out exactly which Eagle Scout he was. I think it's number 74. As best I can nail down the research, he was the 74th Eagle Scout in the United States. And what he used the scouts for was to prove that he was a guy. You know, he couldn't play sports. The sports culture, the jockocracy, was taking over, you know, American high schools very much in the 1900s when he was a high school student. I actually found one of his classmates who was 101 years old. The guy was old as dirt. You know, a beautiful old man. And I talked to him about Alfred Kinsey. And I said, tell me about Al. He says, Al? He says, tallest kid in the class. But he wouldn't play ball. He wouldn't play ball. God damn it, he wouldn't play baseball. God damn it, he wouldn't play basketball. He said, the son of a bitch was worthless. then there was a long pause. He said, well, he was the valedictorian. But get that, the son of a bitch was worthless, okay? All right, that's what Kinsey was up against. He was smart, he was, you know, physically large, you know, for his age as a man, but he had a heart defect that couldn't let him do stuff. So he found other ways to excel. And what he excelled at was studies. He became the valedictorian. He excelled at being a Boy Scout and a devastating hiker. That guy would walk you into the ground, okay? And then the third thing was he excelled at classical music. He wanted to become a concert pianist, and for reasons that I won't burden you with, but I'm at labor to explain in the book, like the lack of talent, he couldn't do it. So he buried himself in his studies. When he got ready to go to college, his father, who was the head of shop practice, okay, a kind of blue-collar guy who finds a niche for himself in an engineering school, at the Stevens Institute of Technology. He took those incipient engineers and made them do hands-on, you know, practice stuff with, you know, metal and working stuff. But you know, he had a kind of quasi-faculty appointment and was very proud of it. He insisted that Kinsey go to the Stevens Institute and become an engineer. And so Kinsey did. And for 2 years, he threw the fight. For the only time in his life, he made bad grades. This is a guy who can, you know, who's brilliant, but who suddenly has started making, you know, C's and B's and, you know, a D here and there. And then finally, after 2 years of being square peg and round hole, he gets out. And he just says to his dad, look, he says, I can't do this. I want to be a biologist. I want to study biology. You know, I want to be the next Darwin, you know. And his dad says, no, you're going to be an engineer. So there was this cataclysmic explosion in the front yard, and Kinsey walks away. Freud says, you've got to be strong to kill your father. You've got to be strong to kill your father. That's a moment of strength in Alfred Kinsey. His father responds by sawing off his end of the table, breaking his plate, and disowning him. I'm not kidding. That was it. That ripped the relationship. Kinsey went to a little school in New England that some of you will know, Bowdoin College. And in Bowdoin College, he falls under the spell of two great young biologists. They recognize in him a star pupil. And a couple of years later, all the academic chaos has been mended. They forgive his bad grades. They go away magically, you know, from the Stevens Institute. And he graduates Phi Beta Kappa at the top of his class and earns a fellowship to Harvard. When he goes to Harvard, his goal is really to make an impact in science. Kinsey has an ego that would fill this room. Okay, he's not a modest man. He's not a modest man. He's a driven man. He has spring coil vitality that comes from conflict that I'll talk about in a few minutes. At Harvard, he's at the crossroads because really science is at the crossroads. You can do a couple of things to make a splash. You can use the Darwin model, the natural history model of the 19th century, and you can go down that road and become a great descriptive biologist. Or there's a new kid on the block. It's called genetics. Morgan at Columbia will win a Nobel Prize in that field. You can use genetics to talk about evolution. Kinsey is at that Y, and he chooses natural history. He becomes a field biologist, and he plunges into what is the thorniest issue for any biologist who wants to study basic units of life. He gets into the species controversy. If you're a taxonomist and you want to make a mark, then you talk about the species conflict. And when you do that, you come down on one of two sides of an issue. You're either an essentialist or an anti-essentialist. You're a Platonist, okay, or you're not. You know, the allegory of the caves and all that stuff. Kinsey is an anti-essentialist. If he scoops up a handful of seashells and looks at them, he starts tossing the ones away that look like the phenotype. He doesn't want that. He wants the one that's gnarled and doesn't look like the others. Because when he sees that, he thinks he's in the presence of evolution. And when he thinks he's in the presence of evolution, he thinks he is moving down that road to having taxonomy have explanatory power, okay, with regard to evolutionary theory. So in addition to choosing this path, he also chooses a methodology. And his methodology, filled with ego, rotten with ego, he goes to the banks of his, you know, library, and he looks at the doctoral dissertations that Wheeler, William Wheeler at Harvard. If you still want to read elegant books on ants, his books are still in print. They were published in the teens and the 20s, and they're literally still in print. He is one of the leading lights in the world on social insects, termites, ants, and stuff. He looks at these books, and the books talk about, you know, the species issue on the basis of 50 or 100 or in some instances as many as 200 species, specimens, individual insects. And those individual insects will have been analyzed to death. You know, they'll have 18 measurements on them, you know, thoracic cavities, blah, 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 antennae, how long, all this stuff. And then you write this up and you say what this tells us about the continuum of change within an individual species. All right, Kinsey looks at that literature and he says it's bogus. It's flaccid. It's intellectually bankrupt. And it's flaccid, bogus, and intellectually bankrupt because it rests upon anemic, parsimonious sampling. What he wants is to get a muscular sample, one that is so formidable that it will show across a wide continuum of variation evolution at a level of clarity that has never been brought into focus. So, at Harvard, Wheeler's, his mentor's method of training graduate students was to give them freedom. Kinsey disappears for a couple of years. You know, he goes out and he selects an insect. And the insect he selects is the gall wasp. And if you want to study an insect that really is very interesting from an evolutionary standpoint, study gall wasps, because they have enormous variation within the species. When Kinsey turns in his doctoral dissertation, guess how many insects he's collected? 17,000. I'll repeat, 17,000. Of those 17,000, he collects them across, you know, a range of different topographies, different geography, different sites. He makes 26 different measurements of each insect, and he mounts them individually, and he writes up his data. Whether it's, you know, numbing, boring, bung, whatever, the sheer sweat of the effort, the sheer sweat capital in that dissertation is phenomenal. His fellow graduate students started calling him because he brought it upon himself. They say, "Al, how many insects do you intend to collect in your life?" And under this voice, a million. I won't settle for less than a million. So what do they call him? Get a million, Kinsey! Get a million, Kinsey! They think he's nuts. All right, Wheeler thinks he's a force of nature. And he writes in letters saying, "I've got a graduate student who's going to use field biology to interpret evolution in a way that we've never seen before. He's going to redeem taxonomy from being this kind of, you know, hobby of rich guys and natural history folks, antiquarian types. He's going to redeem that. He's going to make himself the second Darwin." Glowing letters. So Kinsey goes and gets his first job, the only job he ever had. He becomes a professor at Indiana University. He rises very quickly through the professorial ranks. He's a hard worker. He publishes. Two monographs come out. Boom, boom. Lots of good, heavy science. And he's making the jump. He's not only publishing in the entomology and taxonomy journals, he's starting to get in natural history, he's starting to get in science, he's starting to get in those magazines that have some cachet. So he is starting to make the leap from being niche player to a guy who's going to have some authority over a field. And while he's doing this, you know, he develops a reputation on campus, blah, blah, blah. He also, for the first time, shows an interest in women. Let's talk about Kinsey's sex life. I've got him in place now. He's a full professor. He's had a rocket on his back. He's shot through the professorial ranks, and he's earned his spurs at a young age. What's going on behind all the hard work, Al? Well, the answer is a very tortured man, a very conflicted man, a guy who works out in his workplace inner conflicts. Kinsey, at a very early age, had homosexual urges. Kinsey, at a very early age, punished himself with great severity for having any sexual thoughts, let alone homosexual thoughts. As a result, Kinsey developed, at an early age, a private history of sadomasochism. He was into doing things that hurt him, okay? He was into urethral insertions. Exquisite pain. Every guy in the room goes, "Ah!" You know, exquisite pain. Okay, urethral insertions, and he was into other stuff that was very, very heavy SM. All of this private. All of that within the conspiracy of silence. All of this out of view. All of this self-inflicted pain and punishment, sub rosa. All right? He doesn't date in high school. He doesn't date in college. He doesn't date until he gets to Indiana University and he meets Mac McMillan, okay? She's played brilliantly by Laura Linney in the film, okay? With Mac, he finds a kindred spirit. She's a tomboy. You know, the first year they date, actually the first couple of months they date, he gives her a present. You know what he gives her? Hiking boots. what every girl wants, right? Hiking boots. He gives her hiking boots and a compass, you know. Wow! You know, how romantic is that? Hiking boots and a compass. All right. So he falls in love. There's nothing phony about it, you know. He is under enormous societal pressure to be heterosexual. He wants to conform. He wants to be a man in the way his culture tells him to be a man. He courts her. He woos her. He wins her. They get married. And they have four children in pretty rapid succession within a decade. One of the four tragically dies. Their first son dies of a terrible illness at the age of two. He's diabetic, goes into a diabetic coma, can't be saved. It's before insulin. So Kinsey has his private life. It looks, for all purposes, fashion-wise. You know, he's fulfilled the cultural script, except it ain't working. He's still got this terrible conflict inside him, and he still, you know, wants men. He doesn't want women. So he develops a private life then, in which he kind of, you know, chases graduate students, and they kind of keep him at bay, you know. And there's this big open secret, you know, that he's strange. Alfred is strange. He finds a way in the 1930s. He joined the faculty, to give you a date, in 1920. By 1930, he's a full professor. He finds a way in the 1930s to begin to act upon his concerns about society. And that is that there's a student petition at Indiana University in 1937 to offer a sex education class. Now, in point of fact, there had been a sex education class offered, but it was that former sex education of the social hygiene movement, hush and pretend, keep it in your pants, keep your knees locked. No useful information, just a social warrant of abstinence was the thrust of that class. So what happened was that the president of Indiana University, who was an old Victorian, retires. There's a new president, Herman Wells, comes in, and Herman's cool. Herman's 34 years old. He's the former dean of the business school. You know, he was known to wear a raccoon coat and, you know, drink out of a flask. Herman's cool. And so what Herman does is to say to the faculty, okay, the log jam's broken. What new classes, you know, should we have been teaching that we haven't been teaching? And he gives his blessing to the marriage course. The marriage course launches Kinsey into what will become the career that you know him by, the sex researcher, all right? What he does is to put together an interdisciplinary class. He saves the meat of the class, the juicy stuff, for himself, but he brings in a lot of heavy hitter senior faculty. They teach the class, and then Kinsey has this epiphany. The folklore is that a student raises his hand and says, Professor Kinsey, in the marriage class, Professor Kinsey, is masturbation harmful? Everybody goes, you know, there's this big gasp, collective gasp. And Kinsey, the folklore goes, I don't know. The truth is, society doesn't know. We don't have data. And without data, we don't know what's harmful, we don't know what's useful, we just don't know, because this is an area we've all been scared to death of. But if you will talk to me about your sexual histories, I'll begin to compile data. Okay. The truth of the matter is that it's much more calculating. All right. Kinsey went into that class intending to use his students as his subjects. He had already put together in his mind the beginning of what became his tour de force interview. And I want to talk for a minute about that, the interview itself. Kinsey thought that the only way you could shed light on private life was to get people to talk candidly about issues they'd never disclosed. And he thought the only way you could do this was to put them in a situation where they had absolute confidence in the person with whom they were talking, and absolute confidence that the information they gave that person would never become public, that it would be subsumed in aggregate data, and the individual's identity would be lost. So Kinsey's genius, okay, was to think of a way to do this. what he did was to work out a code. And the code, he was very vain about the code. He, you know, had the conceit that a cryptologist couldn't break it in a month. I suspect a good cryptologist would have broken it in a day, you know, but be that as it may. He took a person's history on a sheet of paper with a position code with a series of marks, some of which were shorthand, some of which were dots and dashes, some of which were numbers. It looks like gibberish. But on that sheet of paper, he can take about 2.5 hours of discussion. Okay, 2.5 hours of discussion. What he did was to make appointments with the students who would volunteer. And the students who wouldn't volunteer, by the way, he pressured mightily to volunteer. He'd make appointments with them. They would go into the inner sanctum of his office, into the chamber of true confession, and Kinsey would interview them. And the interviews would start out with very neutral stuff. What's your name? What's your birthday? You know, kind of non-threatening issues. And then it would move very rapidly into private life. And the way Kinsey would structure the questions was that he would put the burden of denial, okay, on the person. So he wouldn't say, have you ever masturbated? He'd be looking down with his pen in his hand and say, at what age did you first masturbate? Okay? And then, okay, what fantasy were you having? All right. He would then ask questions staccato, or rapido, okay? He'd ask them so fast that you'd have a hard time juggling a lie if you were going to tell it. He would build trip questions, tripwire questions, so that if you said something in one part of the interview, he'd go back and revisit it at another part of the interview and make sure the data were consistent, the answers were consistent. And he would use language that was class appropriate. Later, when he would start interviewing prostitutes, you know, his question was, how long have you been in the life? Okay? Well, you either have to, you know, say, well, I've been hooking for, you know, 10 years, or say, what the hell do you mean the life? All right? Or he'd say, you cruise tea rooms, right? Do you like lettuce you know, with your salad? Well, okay, you either have to say, okay, I'm a gay guy, I go to public urinals, that's a tea room, and I prefer a guy who has foreskin, that's lettuce with my salad. Okay? He mastered all the argo, okay, all the jargon. He became a master of that language. And he used that to elicit from people. Then he would tell people, okay, you know, he would walk them through every permutation of sexual behavior, checking off the list of yes, no, when did you do it, how many times did you do it, blah, blah, blah. And he would do it in this fatherly, reassuring manner that everybody does it. And you would either say, yes, I have, or no, I haven't. And then you'd, you know, tell him what you did. And then what he would tell you after the end of the interview, he'd turn that piece of paper around and say, what did you tell me? And you'd see all this gibberish. You know, you can't make, he said, do you see your name anywhere? You see your name? No. He said, well, guess what? I'm going to take this and I'm going to correlate it with my other data, and your identity is going to disappear. It's going to go right into aggregate data, and you'll never be recognizable. Tell your friends. They can tell me the truth. One of my favorite, you know, Kinsey stories, when he's, you know, moving beyond his students, the students were where he learned his craft as an interviewer. Later, he'll interview an amazing assortment and a continuum of people. And one of my favorite stories, because I interviewed the doctor, there was a woman who was a very famous gynecologist in New York. And I asked her about, you know, Kinsey as an interviewer. She said, he was brilliant. She said, you've never seen anybody in your life who could extract from you, just like, you know, sucking every ounce of behavior out of you like this guy could do. And she said, I remember, you know, he asked me how many extramarital, you know, contacts I'd had. And she said, there was a pause. I paused. And Kinsey, you know, said, you know, it's all right. I'm, you know, I just, you know, it's okay. You can tell me. She said, be quiet. I'm counting. So Kinsey puts together the interview. And then he has to figure out how you take this kind of skill. And this one guy working by himself, and how you translate that into a juggernaut, into a machine, you know, that can collect aggregate data. So what he does is to decide to clone himself. And he hires assistants. And he trains his assistants mercilessly in his methodology of how you do interviews, okay? And he puts together a team of interviewers that can do what he does, always under his very exacting standards of duplicating his methodology. Methodology is the soul of science, okay? It's the soul of science. And he had to be sure in his mind that they would follow it. Now, how do you take a guy who is at Indiana University, builds a staff, puts together, you know, his inner core, his inner circle of devoted devotees, and how do you get that off the ground? The answer is money. You got to have money. Follow the money. Follow the money. And this is where the social tensions in our society respond to a perceived need. There is a group called the Committee for Research in Problems of Sex. And it is a standing committee of the National Research Council, which was created in 1916 to be the working arm of the Academy of Sciences to help solve war problems. All right, this committee has a hard time getting scientists to serve on it. Sex, when the committee is created, which was in 1921, was still verboten. The National Institute, Committee for Research and Problems of Sex issued a call saying, we want distinguished scientists to step forward, and they were greeted by no hands going up. So finally, they gave the assignment to a guy named Robert M. Yerkes. Anybody know him? Yeah, heavy hitter. Yerkes was a young psychologist, Harvard PhD. He was the guy who put together Army Alpha and Army Beta, testing in World War I, psychological testing in World War I, so it could appear that you were making officers on the basis of merit, and grunts on the basis of no merit. So when he came out of creating Army Alpha and Army Beta, he did his brilliant work on experimental psychology, The Dancing Mouse, other books, and he was very much a young man on the make. He wanted psychology to find a place outside of philosophy departments. He wanted to get it a place in university curricula, okay? And he wanted to have cultural authority. So anything that he thought could advance the purpose of psychology, he grabbed. He grabbed the Committee of Research for Problems of Sex. He said, I'll be chairman. And in that period, the first 10 years, the Rockefeller Foundation, using the Bureau of Social Hygiene as its front man, gave money to the Committee for Research and Problems of Sex to launder it, to make it, you know, kosher, safe. What happened in that first 10 years was a scientific revolution that no one could have foreseen because no one knew how it was going to turn out. Basically, infrahuman research filled the void because most scientists were too timid to work on people. But out of that infrahuman research would come a couple of Nobel Prizes in endocrinology because the sex hormones, okay, were isolated by members of this committee. It's a fascinating story of indirection. And what happens is that a firm basis is laid studying subhumans for the next layer of studies on human behavior. It's really cool. If you look at the final reports, you read something like the compensatory left gonad of the head, you know, will be the object of study. All right. But after 10 years of studying humans, this committee is on the make. They want somebody who's going to study human beings. And when Alfred Kinsey in 1941 knocks on that door and says, I want to study human sexuality, and I have a methodology, and I am a disinterested scientist, and I can tell society what's normal and what's not normal using data, they say, show me. So what happens is that Yerkes and George W. Corner, who's another heavy hitter in science, and a guy from Johns Hopkins, Dr. Reed, who is one of the fathers of public health in this country, all go to Bloomington, Indiana, paid for by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they go to scrutinize Kinsey. And what Kinsey does is turn the tables. He said, the only way you're going to find out whether I'm for real is to give me your sexual histories. He turns the tables. It's point, set, match. He eats them alive. They come out of that, you know, room of true confession. They go back to the Rockefeller Foundation, and they say, it's time to spring the Yale lock. Give this boy money. And so, my God, how the money rolls in. Kinsey gets more money per year than all the other applicants to the Committee for Research and Problems of Sex combined. In fact, he gets so much that he's a hog. You know, nobody else can get to the trough. So the Rockefeller Foundation creates a separate budget for Kinsey. 50 grand a year, a princely sum then, for nothing but his research. Ultimately, they'll put $451,000, which in pre-war dollars, excuse me, is a shitload of money. Okay, so Kinsey has every academic's fantasy. He has nothing but money to work with. So he builds his staff, he grinds out those books, and in 1948, he publishes Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. You can't imagine the impact of that book. I invite you, as a fun thing to do, get some microfilm. Look at the size of the front page banners on the Kinsey reports. Look at five national magazines that put Kinsey's portrait on the front page. Hey! He's the second Darwin. He's done it. He has found a way to bring himself in society about the issues he cares most about. When you read the Mail volume, you see a person who draws upon 18,000 sexual histories. 6,000 of those are pertinent to the data that he releases in the Mail volume. There has never, in the history of science up to that point, been any window with a lens so sharp into the bedroom. Never before could you say with the specificity that Kinsey brought to private life what people actually did. And he wrote about it. He wrote about it with this matter-of-fact tone. You know, you do this, you do that, you do this, you do that, some of this, some of that, okay? And then, reading between the lines in this book, you are in the presence of a sexual revolutionary. Because what Kinsey cannot do is keep from telling you the implications of his data. What needs to change in the light of what he's just told you? So he will walk you through the sex offender codes, and he will say, do we really want to put somebody in prison because they had mouth genital contact? Do we really want to say that gays, you know, are a marginal group in our society when 10% of the people I've interviewed are gay? Do we really want to fill in the blank? It goes on and on and on. So he comes before us, spewing his numbers and pleading with every breath in his body for an ethic of tolerance. And the tolerance he wants is for all the people whose misery he's seen, and he wants it badly for himself. He's found a way to make his private public and his public private. He's found a way to join the fissures in himself, to harness himself to the things he cares most about. After the Mail volume is published, there is a furor of activity. I love academics. Academics are my tribe. I love academics. But I'll tell you, if you want a group of people who are as gentle as folks who scuttle ships or slit throats, find academics, because academics know how to put the knife in and twist it. People couldn't stand the amount of attention Alfred Kinsey got. First of all, Kinsey had the bad taste and actually bad judgment to knock the Freudians. He thought Freud was a moralist, and he said so again and again and again in his book. Freud is a moralist. Freud has no data to support his, you know, injunctions against homosexuality or this or that, or his prescriptive model of behavior. Freud is a bloody moralist. So in 1948, if you're on the East Coast and you're at Columbia or you're at Harvard or you're at Yale, you're in the group or presence of a group of academics, many of whom pray to Freud nightly. He is a patron saint. And for Kinsey to piss in Freud's ear, which he did, Kinsey couldn't understand why he got negative reviews. Margaret Mead savages him. Margaret Mead writes an interview in which she savages him. I could go down the list. But what's interesting about the response to Kinsey is that it precipitates the most serious cultural debate in American history to that point on private life. Academics way into the fray. You've got people who go to the wall for Kinsey, and you've got people who declaim and denounce him. But whether bricks or roses, what happens in boardrooms, what happens in academic seminars, what happens in barbershops, what happens in street corners, is that people are talking about what? Sex. Kinsey shatters the conspiracy of silence. He shatters it. It's gone forever. Kinsey gives Americans permission in the name of science to talk about sex. And once that genie's out of the bottle, he ain't going back. Okay, he ain't going back. So Kinsey takes, you know, or actually Kinsey's kind of funny. He can't understand any academic who criticizes him. He's wounded. He's absolutely wounded, and he thinks, you know, they're betraying him, and, you know, why don't the Freudians like me? he's very obtuse. All right. What happens then is that Kinsey comes up against what Teddy Roosevelt once said. You know, God save you from the werewolf and your heart's desire. The heart's desire he had, his name was a part of our language. He was arguably, after Einstein, the best known scientist in the world. All right? At the same time this is happening, the forces of repression about the discourse he has unleashed attack mercilessly. In the late 40s, we get the precursors and beginning of the McCarthy era. All right? And McCarthy understands brilliantly that one of the pressure points in our society is sex. And so he talks about homosexuals in the State Department, he talks about communists in the Army, he talks about all these ghoulish people who are sending America to hell in a handbasket. And the result is that Congress convenes a special committee to investigate tax-exempt foundations. The real reason this happened, you remember a guy named Wayne Hayes from Ohio? Okay. I interviewed Wayne Hayes among, you know, many other people, because Wayne Hayes was the Democrat enfant terrible on that committee. He would scream at the Republicans, "You guys are fascists, you know, blah blah." What he told me was that B. Carroll Reese, who was the chair of the committee, a congressman from Tennessee, a former head of the GOP's national committee, he said B. Carroll Reese believed that the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation had pulled levers, used their money, conspired behind the scenes to cost Robert Taft the Republican nomination in 1952 and to swing it to Eisenhower, who was more liberal. And that, therefore, they were responsible for their darling conservative not getting the brass ring. So to punish him, they go after the Rockefeller Foundation. B. Carroll Reese convened the special committee to investigate tax-exempt foundations, and his target number one was Rockefeller. He brought in the Rockefeller Foundation, and guess what club he picked up and beat him over the head with? Alfred Kinsey. Do you think we should be supporting godless research? Can't you see that Kinsey's data undermine the sanctity of the home? Can't you see that it absolutely disparages American womanhood? Can't you see that it's godless, heartless, religious science? And can't you see that Kinsey is a fellow traveler? The communists are cheering from the stands. Kinsey, by the way, was a Republican. Deeply conservative in his political views. All right, in the last years of Kinsey's life, he fights an epic battle and sees everything that he ever wanted evaporate in front of him. He publishes the female volume. It stirs up even more controversy than the male. The battle lines are drawn. He has great academic defenders. He has great academic disparagers. He's in the vortex. He's in the belly of the beast. He is savaged for the left and the right. What happens is that the last few years of his life, okay, Kinsey implodes. Ego does not rally. He is a broken man. He fears that all of the things he wanted to accomplish about normalization of attitudes toward groups that are marginalized, he fears that all of the heavy blows he has struck on behalf of having people be able to talk openly about their sexual lives, he fears that all the social warrant of inclusion and tolerance has been defeated. And consequently, the sadomasochism that was a salient part of his life from the beginning becomes more and more ugly. He hurts himself in ways that can only be described as tragic and heartbreaking. At the end of his life, he is a shadow of himself. He has seen the Rockefeller Foundation withdraw its support. He has seen everything that he thought he had accomplished go up in vapor. And he feels that he has failed in the great mission of his life. He continues to work despite the fact that he is in congestive heart failure. He works himself to the point that he dies. He just, you know, he can't stop. He's compulsive. And he dies a very, very sad figure. All right. Mike Kinsey is, I think, a tragic hero. He took parts of our culture that were at odds with itself. He took parts of himself that were twisted, okay, and gnarled, and he put them into what he understood to be a noble cause. If he were standing before us now, he'd be spouting his numbers. He'd be begging between every line of those disinterested numbers for tolerance. And he'd be pleading for a place at the table and for open discourse about a subject that had been far too long closed. Thanks.
Seem to have gained numbers, but that's okay. We have time for a question and answer period, so if you have any questions,
absolutely.
Thank you. That was a wonderful speech.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, he worked on the theories, but did he have any philosophy attached to that? Like afterwards, did he ask questions?
He does have a philosophy. Thank you for the question. Remember, I talked earlier about his approach to taxonomy, about the essentialist and the anti-essentialist. Okay, that philosophy of science exactly informs his research on human sexual behavior. And here's how it works. Kinsey correctly understood that our society is a richly veined, richly variated society, that it had class distinctions, that it had educational fault lines, that it had geographical differences, degree of religiosity. So what he did was to manage to kind of parcel, cut into very, very fine strips how you do social research. And he would, I think ultimately there are 37 variables that he looks at. And what's interesting about that, and here I'm going to be a pedant for a minute, okay, is that the history of polling, the history of sampling group behavior, is not that old, okay? And Kinsey is absolutely a pioneer. One of the great debates that his work creates is that they go after him. The statisticians go after him, and the social scientists go after him for having an unrepresentative sample, okay? And his response to that is, hey, I'd love a representative sample, but I'll tell you what, I can't promise you that if I go into a room and say I want everyone here to give me their sex histories, that you'll do it. So I have what statisticians would call a grab sample, right? I grab the ones I can. But within grabbing the ones I can, I go to so many places, and I work with so many groups, and I work with so many different classes of people, and I work with so many different venues, that I start to get a sample that looks pretty damn interesting. Okay, his philosophy of science was anti-essentialism. And just as he thought you could not generalize about a species, based upon 50 insects, you had to have 17,000, okay? He also argued that you can't say what people do based upon a priori assumption or moral prescript. You can't say that, okay, because this is what we're taught, this is how people behave. He said, not until we look into the bedrooms, okay, pull back those sheets, get a good, hard, long look at lots of people in lots of situations from lots of different backgrounds, can we begin to understand and explain what people do. And then always implicit in that what people do was the notion that sexual mores needed to be redefined in light of behavior. What he wants to do is to elevate, okay, practice to theory, okay, and theory to practice. Okay, that's the history of science. Yeah.
My understanding is that there were recent surveys also funded by the NRC, the National Research Council, which basically did not support the data that Kinsley had.
Right.
How has the data stood the test?
It's really interesting. Parts of Kinsey's data have worn well. Parts of Kinsey's data have been roughed up badly. I think I think like Macbeth's dagger, it just takes us in the direction that Shakespeare wants us to go. With Kinsey, I think the data on homosexual behavior is inflated. And the reason it's inflated is that he skewed his research by, in effect, targeting that group. If you're going to have data that's representative, then you can't single out a group and have a disproportionate number of those people represented. So Kinsey's 10% figure, which was a great political tool for gay rights in this country, because it's double digits and there's power in numbers. I took some really nasty hits on my Kinsey biography from a set of gay reviewers who hate me, who think that I'm the Antichrist. I was accused of being a Christian stooge and a fundamentalist and a bunch of other things that are interesting. And the reason is that I call it into question. I do it in my biography. I simply say that these data have not worn well. Other parts, though, age of first sexual contact, things that aren't loaded, but are kind of much more garden variety behavioral issues, I think his data are rock solid. So I think what you have to do when you read it is read it with a skeptical appreciation of what is valuable, okay, and what needs to be discarded, okay? Yep.
Did Kinsey try to explain the differences between men and women and their level of sexual activity at all?
Absolutely. The question was, does Kinsey get into the gender disparity between men and women? Yes, he does. Kinsey, in many ways, Kinsey's image of female sexuality is Victorian. Okay? People like to think that we escape our cultural moorings, our roots, and that we can rise above cultural influence. But I think Kinsey, in general, had a view of female sexuality that was largely judgmental, okay? And what I mean by that is that he thought that women had less interest in sex. He thought that women wanted sex less often, that they did not come to orgasm with the consistency or frequency that men did, and that they were, if anything, a kind of inhibiting influence on male sexuality, because Kinsey's notion of male sexuality, I think, was largely forged in a gay male culture, okay, that had numerous partners and lots of activity, okay? So what happens is that he has this preconceived notion, and then as he interviews people, part of those ideas are disabused by data, and he comes to have a with Kinsey number I'm thinking how to put this with him, numbers matter, okay? You know, he wants more. What Kinsey wants is more and better sex for everybody, more and better sex. So if he can find women who are sexually very active, something I didn't get into, but Kinsey actually filmed behavior. He was one of the great dark secrets of the Kinsey Institute was that long before Masters and Johnson, you know, in their clinical studies, got into filming behavior for, quote, therapeutic purposes, end quote, Kinsey, in the attic of his home, brought in numerous couples. He had a professional photographer, and he gets into sex hot and heavy. And the thing that's really cool is that Mrs. Kinsey, you know, Mac, will come up there, and there's this, you know, I don't know how to put it, there's this wonderful cult of domesticity insinuating itself into the laboratory, because she will come in with towels, you know, for people to dry off. She'll come in with milk and cookies, no, and, you know, and pats on the head, you know, and, you know, there she goes, you know, Mrs. Kinsey, you know, domesticating this scene. So, you know, with Kinsey, I mean, one of the great debates in science in the 40s and 50s is, you know, vaginal or clitoral orgasm, right? So how do you solve that? If you're an empiricist, well, I'll tell you what you do. You know, you go into the vaginal barrel, and you go in there with electric, you know, stimulus, and you see whether whether there is ethereal tissue, whether it responds to stimuli, or whether it is indeed a dead cavity. What he hated Freud for, you know, was that Freud dismissed clitoral orgasm as, you know, juvenile and self-indulgent and, you know, prepubescent and blah, blah, blah. And Kinsey says, you got to study things, you know, you got to find out what you're talking about, Jack. And the women that I'm looking at, you know, they really like that spot. So you better, you know. All right. Kinsey, you know, Kinsey kind of warms up to female sexuality over time. But truth be told, he always saw women through a cultural prism. He always saw them as agents of restraint. He always saw them ultimately as kind of an anchor or an inhibitor, you know, for men. And he always thought that in a better world, you know, women would, you know, have to be socialized over many generations to achieve their full sexual potential. What blew his mind was that he, you know, he met some women, and they were actually photographed, I've seen the photographs, who were multi-orgasmic. And, you know, Kinsey had a hard time thinking of a man who could, you know, keep up. So, you know, he had to scratch his head about that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, by way of framing my question, Milton Friedman wrote an article a long time ago trying to distinguish between descriptive and prescriptive economics. And
yep.
then Robert Coase came along and said it's a wonderful article, but it's entirely prescriptive.
Right.
The comments about Freud, I think, are really indicative of this. I mean, do you see Kinsey as being basically a closet prescriptivist? Was he really aware of the extent to which his own biases were influencing his research?
I don't think he was. You know, I thought a lot about that because that's a tough question for any biographer. I think Kinsey bought his scientific integrity argument, hook, line, and sinker. I think if Kinsey had been giving this talk, okay, most of what he would have talked about would have been his methodology. He would have, and actually I can give a whole lecture on his methodology because it's a fascinating topic. But what he would have wanted to do would be to woo you, okay, to impress you and reel you in based upon the rigor, okay, of his methodology. And I think that translates in his mind to, hey, I am a real scientist, and hey, I do this well. I have moral certainty, okay, that Kinsey went to bed at night and saw himself as a powerful scientist and as an honest scientist who never knowingly cooked the books. What good is an ego if it doesn't take care of you? Okay? Yeah.
Thank you for coming out. I wanted to say that I think some of your statistics that you mentioned, or not your statistics, some of Kinsey's statistics really, really shocked me. For example, the 70% of males who patronized a prostitute. How do you think those statistics would change post-sexual revolution, you know, considering that women are putting out more now and maybe the need to go to prostitute has, like, decreased? Like, what do you think would change the statistics would be at this point in time?
Well, I don't think that there's any question that the incidence of men visiting prostitutes has declined. I would bet the farm on that. But I guarantee you, and if Governor Spitzer were, or ex-Governor Spitzer were here, he could probably, you know, elaborate that, yes, men, I was talking with friends last night at dinner, and I was talking about a recent talk I gave at the New York Academy of Medicine, and I was staying at one of the Helmsleys on Central Park South, and I'm cruising back to my hotel, not cruising because that's a loaded word, but I'm going back to my hotel, and there's a middle-aged woman, she's an attractive, well-dressed middle-aged woman, probably late 40s, maybe 50s, and I walk by and she says, would you like a date? And I, no, thank you. I'm going to my room, lady. Thanks. I've got a wife who'd beat the shit out of me. but no thanks. The oldest profession. But I think economists, would sit us down and talk about supply and demand and scarcity and abundance. And if, as you point out with the phrase, women are putting out more, the need for paid services declines. So, yeah. Thank you.
One, two more questions.
Okay. Yes.
What do you think Kinsey would feel about sexual behavior in the time of AIDS?
I thought a lot about that. In the conclusion of Kinsey, in the conclusion of that biography, I kind of had this flighted fantasy, and which I talk about what Kinsey would have thought about subsequent history. And I say that I think that Kinsey would have welcomed the women's movement, women's lib. He would have been there carrying a banner because he would have seen that as liberation, and he is a liberationist. Okay, he wants to liberate people's passion. I think he would have been a very strong advocate of gay rights. Okay, he would have wanted a place at the table, and he would have used his data as he did during his life to try to normalize attitudes. And I think with regards to the HIV epidemic, Kinsey would have told anyone who would listen, to practice safe sex, but to have sex. But I think he would have been appalled by the carnage, and I think he would have seen it as not as God's punishment, as some fundamentalists want to say, but as a microbial insult to sexual liberation that had to be addressed rationally. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Do you think that there are any sort of taboos that are left to be explored empirically today? I mean, just considering that...
I will, yeah. You mean with regard to private life, private affected behavior?
Yeah.
Yeah. My response to that would be every generation needs a Kinsey report. Absolutely. because we, you know, we still don't know what changes over time. We have a lot of suspicions, and we have a lot of impressions, and a lot of anecdotal information. But I'll tell you what, if I were at the Rockefeller Foundation and I had all that money to work with, I would support every generation, okay, a study of private life. I sure would, because I'd want to have policy informed by data. Kinsey's bag. Thank you very much.